6. The cellar of the barn was spuriously cool, dank, smelling of cobwebs and earthwater. The sun lit it in dusty rays from narrow windows, but here was none of the day's heat. The boy kept the hawk here, and the bird seemed comfortable enough. David no longer hunted the sky. His feathers had lost the radiant animal brightness of 3 years ago, but the eyes were still as piercing and motionless as ever. "You cannot friend a hawk," they said, "unless you are half a hawk yourself, alone, and only a sojourner in the land, without friends or the need of them. The hawk pays no coinage to love or morals." David was an old hawk now. The boy hoped that he himself was a young one. "Hi," he said softly, and extended his arm to the tethered perch. The hawk stepped onto the boy's arm and stood motionless, unhooded. With his other hand, the boy reached into his pocket and fished out a bit of dried jerky. The hawk snapped it deftly from between his fingers and made it disappear. The boy began to stroke David very carefully. Court most probably would not have believed it if he had seen it, but Court did not believe the boy's time had come, either. "I think you die today," he said, continuing to stroke. "I think you will be made a sacrifice, like all those little birds we trained you on. Do you remember? No? It doesn't matter. After today, I am the hawk, and each year on this day I'll shoot the sky in your memory." David stood on his arm, silent and unblinking, indifferent to his life or death. "You are old," the boy said reflectively, "and perhaps not my friend. Even a year ago you would have had my eyes instead of that little string of meat, isn't it so? Court would laugh. But if we get close enough to that cherry man, if he don't suspect, which will it be, David? Age or friendship?" David did not say. The boy hooded him and found the jesses which were looped at the end of David's perch. They left the barn. 7. The yard behind the great hall was not really a yard at all, but only a green corridor whose walls were formed by tangled, thick-grown hedges. It had been used for the rite of coming of age, since time out of mind, long before Court and his predecessor Mark, who had died of a stab wound from an overzealous hand in this place. Many boys had left the corridor from the east end, where the teacher always entered, as men. The east end faced the great hall and all the civilization and intrigue of the lighted world. Many more had slunk away, beaten and bloody, from the west end, where the boys always entered, as boys, forever. The west end faced the farms and the hut dwellers beyond the farms, beyond that the tangled barbarian forests, beyond that Garlan, and beyond Garlan the Mohane Desert. The boy who became a man progressed from darkness and unlearning to light and responsibility. The boy who was beaten could only retreat forever and forever. The hallway was as smooth and green as a gaming field. It was exactly 50 yards long. In the middle was a swatch of shaven earth. This was the line. Each end was usually clogged with tense spectators and relatives, for the ritual was usually forecast with great accuracy. 18 was the most common age. Those who had not made their test by the age of 25 usually slipped into obscurity as freeholders, unable to face the brutal all-or-nothing fact of the field and the test. But on this day there were none but Jamie de Curry, Cuthbert Allgood, Alan Johns, and Thomas Whitman. They clustered at the boy's end, gape-mouthed and frankly terrified.
"Your weapon, stupid!" Cuthbert hissed in agony. "You forgot your weapon!"
"I have it," the boy said. Dimly he wondered if the news of this lunacy had reached yet to the central buildings, to his mother and to Martin. His father was on a hunt, not due back for days. In this he felt a sense of shame, for he felt that in his father he would have found understanding, if not approval.
"Has Court come?"
"Court is here,"
The voice came from the far end of the corridor, and Court stepped into view, dressed in a short singlet. A heavy leather band encircled his forehead to keep sweat from his eyes. He wore a dirty girdle to hold his back straight. He held an ironwood stick in one hand, sharp on one end, heavily blunted and spatulate on the other. He began the litany which all of them, chosen by the blind blood of their fathers all the way back to the Eld, had known since early childhood, learned against the day when they would, perchance, become men.
"Have you come here for a serious purpose, boy?"
"I have come for a serious purpose."
"Have you come as an outcast from your father's house?"
"I have so come."
And would remain outcast until he had bested Court. If Court bested him, he would remain outcast forever.
"Have you come with your chosen weapon?"
"I have."
"What is your weapon?"
This was the teacher's advantage, his chance to adjust his plan of battle to the sling or spear or ba or bow.
"My weapon is David."
Court halted only briefly. He was surprised, and very likely confused. That was good. Might be good.
"So then have you at me, boy?"
"I do."
"In whose name?"
"In the name of my father."
"Say his name."
"Stephen Deschain, of the line of Eld."
"Be swift, then."
And Court advanced into the corridor, switching his stick from one hand to the other. The boys sighed flutteringly, like birds, as their Dan Din stepped to meet him.
"My weapon is David, teacher." Did Court understand? And if so, did he understand fully? If he did, very likely all was lost. It turned on surprise and on whatever stuff the hawk had left in him. Would he only sit, disinterested and stupid, on the boy's arm, while Court struck him brainless with the ironwood? Or seek escape in the high, hot sky? As they drew close together, each for the nonce, still on his side of the line, the boy loosened the hawk's hood with nerveless fingers. It dropped to the green grass, and Court halted in his tracks. He saw the old warrior's eyes drop to the bird and widen with surprise and slow dawning comprehension. Now he understood.
"Oh, you little fool,"
Court nearly groaned, and Roland was suddenly furious that he should be spoken to so.
"At him,"
he cried, raising his arm, and David flew like a silent brown bullet, stubby wings pumping once, twice, three times, before crashing into Court's face, talons searching, beak digging. Red drops flew up into the hot air.
"Hi, Roland!" Cuthbert screamed deliriously. First blood to my bosom!"
He struck his chest hard enough to leave a bruise there that would not fade for a week. Court staggered backwards, off balance. The ironwood staff rose and beat futilely at the air about his head. The hawk was an undulating, blurred bundle of feathers. The boy, meanwhile, arrowed forward, his hand held out in a straight wedge, his elbow locked. This was his chance, and very likely the only one he'd have. Still, Court was almost too quick for him. The bird had covered 90% of his vision, but the ironwood came up again, spatulate end forward, and Court cold-bloodedly performed the only action that could turn events at that point. He beat his own face three times, biceps flexing mercilessly. David fell away, broken and twisted. One wing flapped frantically at the ground. His cold, predator's eyes stared fiercely into the teacher's bloody, streaming face. Court's bad eye now bulged blindly from its socket. The boy delivered a kick to Court's temple, connecting solidly. It should have ended it, but it did not. For a moment, Court's face went slack, and then he lunged, grabbing for the boy's foot. The boy skipped back and tripped over his own feet. He went down a sprawl. He heard from far away the sound of Jamie screaming in dismay. Court was ready to fall on him and finish it. Roland had lost his advantage, and both of them knew it. For a moment they looked at each other, the teacher standing over the pupil, with gouts of blood pouring from the left side of his face, the bad eye now closed except for a thin slit of white. There would be no brothels for Court this night. Something ripped jaggedly at the boy's hand. It was David, tearing blindly at whatever he could reach. Both wings were broken. It was incredible that he still lived.
The boy grabbed him like a stone, unmindful of the jabbing, diving beak that was taking the flesh from his wrist in ribbons. As Court flew at him, all spread-eagled, the boy threw the hawk upward. "Hi, David, kill!" Then Court blotted out the sun and came down atop of him.
8. The bird was smashed between them, and the boy felt a calloused thumb probe for the socket of his eye. He turned it, at the same time bringing up the slab of his thigh to block Court's crotch-seeking knee. His own hand flailed against the tree of Court's neck in 3 hard chops. It was like hitting ribbed stone. Then Court made a thick grunting. His body shuddered. Faintly, the boy saw one hand flailing for the dropped stick, and with a jackknifing lunge, he kicked it out of reach. David had hooked one talon into Court's right ear, the other battered mercilessly at the teacher's cheek, making it a ruin. Warm blood splattered the boy's face, smelling of sheared copper. Court's fist struck the bird once, breaking its back. Again, and the neck snapped away at a crooked angle, and still the talon clutched. There was no ear now, only a red hole tunneled into the side of Court's skull. A third blow sent the bird flying, at last clearing Court's face. The moment it was clear, the boy brought the edge of his hand across the bridge of his teacher's nose, using every bit of his strength and breaking the thin bone. Blood sprayed. Court's grasping, unseeing hand ripped at the boy's buttocks, trying to pull his trousers down, trying to hobble him. Roland rolled away, found Court's stick, and rose to his knees. Court came to his own knees, grinning. Incredibly, they faced each other that way from either side of the line, although they had switched positions, and Court was now on the side where Roland had begun the contest. The old warrior's face was curtained with gore. The one seeing eye rolled furiously in its socket. The nose was smashed over to a haunted, leaning angle. Both cheeks hung in flaps. The boy held the man's stick like a Grand Points player waiting for the pitch of the rawhide bird. Court double-feinted, then came directly at him. Roland was ready, not fooled in the slightest by this last trick, which both knew was a poor one. The ironwood swung in a flat arc, striking Court's skull with a dull, thudding noise. Court fell on his side, looking at the boy with a lazy, unseeing expression. A tiny trickle of spit came from his mouth. "Yield! Or die," the boy said. His mouth was filled with wet cotton. And Court smiled. Nearly all consciousness was gone, and he would remain tended in his cottage for a week afterward, wrapped in the blackness of a coma. But now he held on with all the strength of his pitiless, shadowless life. He saw the need to palaver in the boy's eyes, and even with a curtain of blood between the two of them, understood that the need was desperate.
"I yield, gunslinger. I yield, smiling. You have this day remembered the face of your father and all those who came before him. What a wonder you have done."
Court's clear eye closed. The gunslinger shook him gently, but with persistence. The others were around him now, their hands trembling to thump his back and hoist him to their shoulders. But they held back, afraid, sensing a new gulf. Yet this was not as strange as it could have been, because there had always been a gulf between this one and the rest. Court's eye rolled open again.
"The key," the gunslinger said. "My birthright, teacher. I need it."
His birthright was the guns. Not the heavy ones of his father, weighted with sandalwood, but guns all the same. Forbidden to all but a few. In the heavy vault under the barracks, where he by ancient law was now required to abide, away from his mother's breast, hung his apprentice weapons, heavy, cumbersome barrel-shooters of steel and nickel. Yet they had seen his father through his apprenticeship, and his father now ruled, at least in name.
"Is your need so fearsome, then?"
Court muttered, as if in his sleep.
"So pressing? I feared so. So much need should have made you stupid. And yet you won.
The key."
"The hawk was a fine ploy, a fine weapon. How long did it take you to train the bastard?"
"I never trained, David. I friended him. The key. Under my belt. Gunslinger.
The eye closed again. The gunslinger reached under Court's belt, feeling the heavy press of the man's belly, the huge muscles there now slack and asleep. The key was on a brass ring. He clutched it in his hand, restraining the mad urge to thrust it up to the sky in a salutation of victory. He got to his feet and was finally turning to the others when Court's hand fumbled for his foot. For a moment, the gunslinger feared some last attack and tensed, but Court only looked up at him and beckoned with one crusted finger.
"I'm going to sleep now,"
Court whispered calmly.
"I'm going to walk the path. Perhaps all the way to the clearing at the end of it. I don't know. I teach you no more, gunslinger. You have surpassed me. And 2 years younger than your father, who was the youngest. But let me counsel."
"What?" Impatiently.
"Wipe that look off your face, maggot."
In his surprise, Roland did as he was bid, although, being crouched hidden behind his face, as we all are, could not know it. Court nodded, then whispered a single word.
"Wait."
"What?"
The effort it took the man to speak lent his words great emphasis.
"Let the word and the legend go before you. There are those who will carry both."
His eyes flicked over the gunslinger's shoulder.
"Fools, perchance. Let your shadow grow hair on its face. Let it become dark."
He smiled grotesquely.
"Given time, words may even enchant an enchanter. Do you take my meaning, gunslinger?"
"Yes, I think I do."
"Will you take my last counsel as your teacher?"
The gunslinger rocked back on his heels, a hunkered, thinking posture that foreshadowed the man. He looked at the sky. It was deepening, purpling. The heat of the day was failing, and thunderheads in the west foretold rain. Lightning tines jabbed the placid flank of the rising foothills miles distant. Beyond that, the mountains. Beyond that, the rising fountains of blood and unreason. He was tired. Tired into his bones and beyond. He looked back at Court.
"I will bury my hawk tonight, teacher, and later go into Lower Town to inform those in the brothels that will wonder about you. Perhaps I will comfort one or two a little."
Court's lips parted in a pained smile, and then he slept. The gunslinger got to his feet and turned to the others.
"Make a litter and take him to his house. Then bring a nurse. No, two nurses, okay?"
They still watched him, caught in a baited moment that none of them could immediately break. They still looked for a corona of fire or a magical change of features.
"Two nurses,"
the gunslinger repeated, and then smiled. They smiled in return, nervously.
"You goddamned horse drover," Cuthbert suddenly yelled, grinning. "You haven't left enough meat for the rest of us to pick off the bone."
"The world won't move on tomorrow," the gunslinger said, quoting the old adage with a smile.
"Alan, you butterbutt, move your freight."
Alan set about the business of making the litter. Thomas and Jamie went together to the main hall and the infirmary. The gunslinger and Cuthbert looked at each other. They had always been the closest, or as close as they could be, under the particular shades of their characters. There was a speculative, open light in Bert's eyes, and the gunslinger controlled only with great difficulty the need to tell him not to call for the test for a year or even 18 months, lest he go west. But they had been through a great ordeal together, and the gunslinger did not feel he could risk saying such a thing without a look on his face that might be taken for arrogance.
"I have begun to scheme," he thought, and was a little dismayed.
Then he thought of Martin, of his mother, and he smiled a deceiver's smile at his friend.
"I am to be the first," he thought, knowing it for the first time, although he had thought of it idly many times before. "I am the first."
"Let's go," he said.
"With pleasure, gunslinger."
They left by the east end of the hedge-bordered corridor. Thomas and Jamie were returning with the nurses already. They looked like ghosts in their white and gauzy summer robes, crossed at the breast with red.
"Shall I help you with the hawk?"
Cuthbert asked. "Yes," the gunslinger said. "That would be lovely, Bert." And later, when darkness had come, and the rushing thunder showers with it, while huge phantom caissons rolled across the sky and lightning washed the crooked streets of the lower town in blue fire, while horses stood at hitching rails with their heads down and their tails drooping, the gunslinger took a woman and lay with her. It was quick and good when it was over, and they lay side by side without speaking. It began to hail with a brief, rattling ferocity. Downstairs and far away, someone was playing Hey Jude ragtime. The gunslinger's mind turned reflectively inward. It was in that hail-splattered silence, just before sleep overtook him, that he first thought that he might also be the last. Nine. The gunslinger didn't tell the boy all of this, but perhaps most of it came through anyway. He had already realized that this was an extremely perceptive boy, not so different from Alan, who was strong in that half-empathy, half-telepathy they called the touch. "You asleep?" the gunslinger asked.
"No."
"Did you understand what I told you?"
"Understand it?"
the boy asked with surprising scorn.
"Understand it? Are you kidding?"
"No." But the gunslinger felt defensive. He had never told anyone about his coming of age before, because he felt ambivalent about it. Of course, the hawk had been a perfectly acceptable weapon, yet it had been a trick, too, and a betrayal, the first of many. "And tell me, am I really preparing to throw this boy at the man in black?"
"I understood it all right," the boy said. "It was a game, wasn't it? Do grown men always have to play games? Does everything have to be an excuse for another kind of game? Do any men grow up, or do they only come of age?"
"You don't know everything," the gunslinger said, trying to hold his slow anger. "You're just a boy."
"Sure, but I know what I am to you."
"And what is that?" the gunslinger asked, tightly.
"A poker chip."
The gunslinger felt an urge to find a rock and brain the boy. Instead, he spoke calmly. "Go to sleep. Boys need their sleep." And in his mind, he heard Martin's echo, "Go and find your hand." He sat stiffly in the darkness, stunned with horror and terrified for the first time in his existence of the self-loathing that might come afterward. Ten. During the next period of waking, the railway angled closer to the underground river, and they came upon the slow mutants. Jake saw the first one and screamed aloud. The gunslinger's head, which had been fixed straight forward as he pumped the handcar, jerked to the right. There was a rotten jack-o'-lantern greenness below them, pulsating faintly. For the first time he became aware of odor. Faint, unpleasant, wet. The greenness was a face, what might be called a face by one of charitable bent. Above the flattened nose was an insectal node of eyes, peering at them expressionlessly. The gunslinger felt an atavistic crawl in his intestines and privates. He stepped up the rhythm of arms and handcar handle slightly. The glowing face faded.
"What the hell was that?"
the boy asked, crawling to him.
"What?
The words stopped dumb in his throat as they came upon and then passed a group of three faintly glowing forms standing between the rails and the invisible river, watching them, motionless.
"They're slow mutants," the gunslinger said. "I don't think they'll bother us. They're probably just as frightened of us as we are of—"
One of the forms broke free and shambled toward them. The face was that of a starving idiot. The faint, naked body had been transformed into a knotted mess of tentacular limbs and suckers. The boy screamed again and crowded against the gunslinger's leg like a frightened dog. One of the thing's tentacle arms pawed across the flat platform of the handcar. It reeked of the wet and the dark. The gunslinger let loose of the handle and drew. He put a bullet through the forehead of the starving idiot face. It fell away, its faint swamp fire glow fading, an eclipsed moon. The gun flash lay bright and branded on their dark retinas, fading only reluctantly. The smell of expended powder was hot and savage and alien in this buried place. There were others, more of them. None moved against them overtly, but they were closing in on the tracks, a silent, hideous party of rubberneckers.
"You may have to pump for me," the gunslinger said. "Can you?"
"Yes."
"Then be ready."
The boy stood close to him, his body poised. His eyes took in the slow mutants only as they passed, not traversing, not seeing more than they had to. The boy assumed a psychic bulge of terror, as if his very id had somehow sprung out through his pores to form a shield. If he had the touch, the gunslinger reasoned, that was not impossible. The gunslinger pumped steadily but did not increase his speed. The slow mutants could smell their terror, he knew that, but he doubted if terror alone would be enough to motivate them. He and the boy were, after all, creatures of the light and whole. "How they must hate us," he thought, and wondered if they had hated the man in black in the same way. He thought not, or perhaps he had passed among them only like the shadow of a dark wing in this greater darkness. The boy made a noise in his throat, and the gunslinger turned his head almost casually. Four of them were charging the handcar in a stumbling way, one of them in the process of finding a hand grip. The gunslinger let go of the handle and drew again with the same sleepy, casual motion. He shot the lead mutant in the head. The mutant made a sighing, sobbing noise and began to grin. Its hands were limp and fish-like, dead. The fingers clove to one another like the fingers of a glove long immersed in drying mud. One of these corpse hands found the boy's foot and began to pull. The boy shrieked aloud in the granite womb. The gunslinger shot the mutant in the chest. It began to slobber through the grin. Jake was going off the side. The gunslinger caught one of his arms and was almost pulled off balance himself. The thing was amazingly strong. The gunslinger put another bullet in the mutant's head. One eye went out like a candle. Still it pulled. They engaged in a silent tug-of-war for Jake's jerking, wriggling body. The slow mutants yanked on him like a wishbone. The wish would undoubtedly be to dine. The handcar was slowing down. The others began to close in. The lame, the halt, the blind. Perhaps they only looked for a Jesus to heal them, to raise them Lazarus-like from the darkness. "It's the end for the boy," the gunslinger thought with perfect coldness. "This is the end," he meant. "Let go and pump or hold on and be buried. The end for the boy." He gave a tremendous yank on the boy's arm and shot the mutant in the belly. For one frozen moment, its grip grew even tighter, and Jake began to slide off the edge again. Then the dead mud mitts loosened, and the slow mutie fell on its face behind the slowing handcar, still grinning.
"I thought you'd leave me," the boy was sobbing. I thought...
"Hold on to my belt," the gunslinger said. "Hold on just as tight as you can."
The hand worked into his belt and clutched there. The boy was breathing in great, convulsive, silent gasps. The gunslinger began to pump steadily again, and the handcar picked up speed. The slow mutants fell back a step and watched them go, with faces hardly human, or pathetically so, faces that generated the weak phosphorescence common to those weird deep-sea fishes that live under incredible black pressure, faces that held no anger or hate, but only what seemed to be a semi-conscious, idiot regret.
"They're thinning," the gunslinger said.
The drawn-up muscles of his lower belly and privates relaxed the smallest bit. "They're—" The slow mutants had put rocks across the track. The way was blocked. It had been a quick, poor job, perhaps the work of only a minute to clear, but they were stopped, and someone would have to get down and move them. The boy moaned and shuddered closer to the gunslinger. The gunslinger let go of the handle, and the handcar coasted noiselessly to the rocks, where it thumped to rest. The slow mutants began to close in again, almost casually, almost as if they had been passing by, lost in a dream of darkness, and had found someone of whom to ask directions. A street-corner congregation of the damned beneath the ancient rock.
"Are they going to get us?" the boy asked calmly.
"Never in life. Be quiet a second." He looked at the rocks. The mutants were weak, of course, and had not been able to drag any of the boulders to block their way, only small rocks. Only enough to stop them, to make someone... "Get down," the gunslinger said. "You'll have to move them. I'll cover you."
"No," the boy whispered. "Please."
"I can't give you a gun, and I can't move the rocks and shoot, too. You have to get down." Jake's eyes rolled terribly. For a moment his body shuddered in tune with the turnings of his mind, and then he wriggled over the side and began to throw rocks to the right and the left, working with mad speed, not looking up. The gunslinger drew and waited. Two of them, lurching rather than walking, went for the boy with arms like dough. The guns did their work, stitching the darkness with red-white lances of light that pushed needles of pain into the gunslinger's eyes. The boy screamed and continued to throw away rocks to either side. Witch glow leaped and danced. Hard to see now, that was the worst. Everything had gone to shadows and afterimages. One of them, glowing hardly at all, suddenly reached for the boy with rubber boogeyman arms, eyes that ate up half the mutie's head rolled wetly. Jake screamed again and turned to struggle. The gunslinger fired without allowing himself to think before his spotty vision could betray his hands into a terrible quiver. The two heads were only inches apart. It was the mutie who fell. Jake threw rocks wildly. The mutants milled just outside the invisible line of trespass, closing a little at a time, now very close. Others had caught up, swelling their number. "All right," the gunslinger said. "Get on, quick!" When the boy moved, the mutants came at them. Jake was over the side and scrambling to his feet. The gunslinger was already pumping again, all out. Both guns were holstered now. They must run. It was their only chance. Strange hands slapped the metal plane of the car's surface. The boy was holding his belt with both hands now, his face pressed tightly into the small of the gunslinger's back. A group of them ran onto the tracks, their faces full of that mindless, casual anticipation. The gunslinger was full of adrenaline. The car was flying along the tracks into the darkness. They struck the four or five pitiful hulks full force. They flew like rotten bananas struck from the stem. On and on into the soundless, flying, banshee darkness. After an age, the boy raised his face into the made wind, dreading and yet needing to know. The ghost of gun flashes still lingered on his retinas. There was nothing to see but the darkness, and nothing to hear but the rumble of the river.
"They're gone,"
the boy said, suddenly fearing an end to the tracks in the darkness, and the wounding crash as they jumped the rails and plunged to twisted ruin. He had ridden in cars. Once his humorless father had driven at 90 on the New Jersey Turnpike, and had been stopped by a cop who ignored the 20 Elmer Chambers offered with his license and gave him a ticket anyway. But he had never ridden like this, with the wind and the blindness and the terrors behind and ahead, with the sound of the river like a chuckling voice, the voice of the man in black. The gunslinger's arms were pistons in a lunatic human factory.
"They're gone,"
the boy said timidly, the words ripped from his mouth by the wind.
"You can slow down now. We left them behind."
But the gunslinger did not hear. They careened onward into the strange dark.